after she concludes, we're going to take questions and leave plenty of time for questions. This conference.
Announce your name and affiliation, if you will, and we'll conclude with Jim. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I have arrived late and in such a rush. I was amazed to find when I went to the shuttle flight in Boston a huge number of people who are coming to Boston, and I am not making this up, they are coming to Boston and clogging the streets to watch other people play golf. I'm going to speak about two basic trends, and my talk will be the least ICANN-specific talk you will see today. Can everyone see that and read this? And those trends are the movement of the Internet, as Tamara so clearly explained, from a self-organizing community, a self-organizing meritocracy, where things weren't or they didn't, to a large international institution which is critical for functioning of business and therefore has some formal governance. And the other thing is the movement of IP. IP used to stand for the Internet Protocol, wherever you said it on the Internet, and now it can also stand for intellectual property. It's the movement of domain names from the domain of speech to the domain of property. And I'm going to start with a quick description of how IP routing works, because it's a little strange, actually. We have to outline what is IP and talk about why it matters. I'm going to make you look at a series of slides about how Internet routing works and the relationship between Internet protocol and the domain name system. And then you're going to have to take this on faith. I'll explain to you why that matters and the implications of that. So, to start with, what is IP? And in this talk, IP is the Internet Protocol. Hans? Thanks. IP is the one thing that has to work on the Internet. It's the core of the Internet. If it breaks, there's not any Internet. If HTTP collapses, it can be resolved. There was an Internet before there was HTTP. There was an Internet before there was a web. But the Internet depends on the Internet Protocol. It's the one thing that if it genuinely breaks and stops functioning, it cannot be fixed. It is the lowest level. And there is no central directory on IP. Now, if you think about telephone numbers, there was always a hierarchy, a place where you could call, and there'll be all the telephone numbers and where the telephone number is and the person to who it corresponds to. There's no central directory in IP. But yes, but there's a hierarchy and it's assigned and your phone number doesn't change that rapidly. Go ahead. There's no 555-1212 on the Internet. All right, so I'm going to take off of Vint Cerf's, shamelessly start with Vint Cerf's concept of packets as postcards. Now imagine packets or postcards, and we're all mail carriers. You don't put it in and send it to the post office, and the post office sorts it and handles it. But at some level, we're all mail carriers. And you don't go to the post office and look up a zip code. What you do is, keep going, you have your own tiny little address book that says to you, this is who's around me. And this is where I send something if I want it to go way away. If I have no clue, I send it to this other person. So imagine routing is a social network. It's a solid analogy because no router figures out where all the IP addresses are. No router has a complete map of the Internet. What routers have is they know which router is next to them, and they have a default router that they feel like, well, probably goes to the backbone. Basically, you know, you can trust this router to get it anywhere. So you're writing your postcard, and you look through your address book, and you say, what's the fastest way
to get this postcard. Oh, I'll send it to Carlos because he lives only one stop away from Pittsburgh. And then once it gets to Pittsburgh, it'll be delivered. And the way the information is updated is occasionally information is broadcast. Now, when that broadcast comes in, the routers do not then say, oh, I have some more information. I'm going to build a huge database, and it will have all the IP addresses. What you do is there's an algorithm for sorting through it, and if it doesn't change your general direction, you continue with that direction. Anything that would go through the default router anyway, it stays in there. So what does this mean? Why does this matter that it's not one big hierarchy? Well, it matters because it's a network of trust. Steve Belvin of AT&T has written particularly well on this, I think, that you accept routing information. It's not signed. It's not validated. You can validate it. It's costly. But there have been errors. For example, the most famed one is a router on the East Coast just decided that it was a left coast kind of router, and its distance to the West Coast immediately became zero. So what happened was all the traffic went to this little router that couldn't handle it, and there was huge packet loss. So the Internet is decentralized. There's no core, and that means there's no core. There's no central obvious targets. There's not the place in IP where you can take the network down. And it means almost anybody can screw it up. Anybody that can hook a server to the network can mess it up, but only so much as the error is detected and addressed, and the routing information loses its trust. So what says IP routing, the thing that has to work and is built on trust, have to do with the domain name system? Well, the domain name system is just a bunch of mnemonics. It would be very hard to remember my address if I told you what it is, which is 128.103. What is it, 190.164? That's me. Just send me email there. It'll get there. But it would be rather difficult to remember that, and it's fairly easy to remember at harvard.edu. So they're mnemonics, but they're important mnemonics. Next slide, please. And then the relationship between domain names and IP addresses isn't trivial, but it can be described fairly simply, in a fairly simple manner. A domain name has to correlate with an IP address if you want to get to that domain. Now, that correlation is not constant. When you go to eToys, it takes you to a machine with an address or to a sprayer that has, you know, their coordinated addresses, but the domain names are static. When you want to add more machines, you can keep the same domain name. You don't have to go out and say, oh, look, I just had to add three more machines. I had to change the network. I hope that everybody who used to go to eToys when it was this set of numbers, would half of you please go to this set of numbers now, please? It makes coordination a little more possible. And the first thing you do when you route is you find that Internet protocol address from the domain name. Okay. Now, what are domain names? There's top-level generic domain names, which reflect its birth in the U.S., gov being U.S.gov. There's top-level country code domains. There's second-level domains. There's third and fourth-level domains, and you can go as down as far as you like. And at each domain level, the administration of that level is handled by the level above it. Harvard offered ksg.harvard.edu, information.harvard.edu, environment.harvard.edu, and then KSG assigns Bullwinkle. So, and whatever silly names and things coming up with. So the billion-dollar question is, who assigns these domain names? Nobody really cares who defines, I would say, very much the gov domain names. But this is the core question. Who decides? And how do they decide who decides? So, and this Internet domain name question is not going to get any easier. There are questions of governance in domain name management. And those questions are only going to become more difficult as the internet becomes global and it becomes and more constituencies and fundamentally different value systems are expressed on the internet. Saudi Arabia just had last month a large conference on electronic commerce. This would not be an easy way to come together and say we need to find a common value system between the Brooklyn Museum and Saudi Arabia. Okay, not easily done. It's not getting easier. But there has to be compromise, and it has to reflect the global growth. Okay, next one. And the purposes of domain names have changed. Here you can see again the growth in international, explicitly international country code domain names, and the fact that the military and org nonprofit domain names, they look like they stay constant, but in fact, what has happened is their rate of exponential growth has kept up with the overall growth of the web. So the functions of domain names are changing, and where the internet is and where the domain names are is changing. So why does it matter? Why does any of this stuff matter at all besides the sheer obvious issue of money? Well, it's the centralized element. When people think they're going to control the internet, the thing they do is they say, well, you know, there's one place we can go, and that's the domain name system root. Well, that is not entirely true, because when a domain name is removed, you're not kicked off the internet. You could still have an IP address. And by telling somebody you don't have a domain name, you are not telling them you cannot get on the internet, and you are not telling them you cannot put a server on the internet. What you're saying is you can't have a nice little mnemonic phrase so that a lot of people will easily come to your site on the internet. And that's an important thing to understand when people talk about policing the internet. Is it possible that people who would trade in illegal drugs and human beings, do you think they would use an unauthorized IP address? So, next slide. And the details is where it gets very difficult. This is where those things which have been, you could say, oh, they seem to be technically some straightforward. We can just trust all the engineers. But, and the engineers are trustworthy, and engineers have done a great job. And I'm, you know, but who owns a word? There was a huge argument in Working Women. A woman, a startup, started a domain site, workingwomen.com. And then the magazine came along many years later and said, hey, we own that phrase. That's not a generic phrase. That's the title of a magazine. On the other hand, when I just said to you Working Women, it wasn't trademarked to most of you. It's not like I said Disney. And when is a domain name speech? I mean, these are real domain names. God hates fags and God loves fags. Are these properties or are these speech? There was, in fact, a bit of a skirmish between these two domains. Was it computer crime or was it political activism? And the gwbush.com site is an excellent example, because if G.W. Bush's campaign owns G.W. Bush, then it's ownership. But the speech on that site is explicitly and clearly political. But then Nike and Disney, these are also words, but I would say it's obvious that they're property. And then so we have to decide, and we have to decide who decides, and we have to decide how they decide. And I wanted to bring forward a couple of cases to consider, and that is gwbush.com is easy because it's obviously political in the most partisan sense of the word, whereas God Loves Fags is political in the larger sense. But what's a cyber squatter versus a first mover? What about when the cyber squatter is actually political? How do you draw that line? PETA.org is People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. They came to the internet after a gentleman who put up a website at PETA.org called People Eating Tasty Animals. And he is deeply morally opposed to vegetarianism. And while that is difficult for me to grasp, that that's a deeply offensive thing, he means it. He believes that vegetarianism is wrong thinking. And was he a first mover, or was he a cyber squatter? Well, PETA has the site now, so he's a cyber squatter. But what about the people who took the risk and they said, I'll build the business? You know, who's not only if it is property, whose property is it? And what makes it property as opposed to speech? I am not in any way suggesting that I have the answers to these questions. I'm just saying that these are questions that need to be more thoroughly addressed and are the core questions, much more so than, to me, than the question of who should be on the board. And there are policies being made now. I want to, now that my first part of the presentation was about what's IP, what's DNS, and why does it matter, and now I'm going to make an argument that one thing that we're seeing here is a self-organizing meritocracy that has exploded and is now coming into formal governance. So imagine that basketball no longer worked, selecting basketball, so we had to select basketball players a different way. I mean, that is an example of a self-organizing meritocracy. And the thing is, to all of us, it is obvious to all of us what works and what does not on a basketball court. You get the, you score or you don't, you know. You drop the ball. It's clear. But technically, for a long time, the same thing was true on the Internet. It was obvious what worked and what didn't work, and you can look at it and see what didn't work and say, you fool, look at that thing. But that's no longer the case. The governance is increasingly obscure to many people, and you can't expect individuals to understand the way their computer works, just like we don't say, well, it's true that the car companies give out exploding cars, but that's okay because you could all get a degree in automotive engineering and figure it out. So we're moving beyond that. So there was, in the beginning, there was John Postel, the self-organizing meritocracy selection. And also, basically, he was willing to do this. And then IANA was the first attempt to move from the meritocracy to institution. John was still critical. John died an unfortunate, early, and untimely death. And just at this time, ICANN became IANA. Now, we're trying to move from two fundamentally different structures of governance. And so we have these core questions that are the ancient questions, but they're all brand new. What's the consent of the governed on the Internet? I mean, you can't do it surely by domain names. I could easily get a domain name in Tobago or Colombia. That doesn't make me a citizen. I'm simultaneously in many places on the Internet. I'm simultaneously doing many things. It doesn't have the deterministic nature that physical space has, as illustrated by the fact that I could not be here when I wanted to, when I was stuck in traffic. So, and ICANN is deciding how the decision of who determines the role of DNS is made, and it may seem like purely technical decisions, and they are structural decisions, but I agree with Tamar that the process is deeply important. And if there is a DNS Bill of Rights, okay, so there's a Bill of Rights, for whom? Whose Bill of Rights? What's an Internet citizen? Should there be a Bill of Rights to protect intellectual property owners, who are even those who have been non-users and late adopters, who were caught, shall we say, flat-footed by first movers? Or domain name holders, people who already own the domain name, or users who have certain expectations when they pull up a domain name. I mean, even if you decided there would be a Bill of Rights, for whom would be the second question. So ICANN was given a series of charges to answer all the previous questions of governance, to meet the needs of all the constituencies and shareholders, to be representative. Oh, and by the way, be really quick about this. This is clearly not possible. So the institution, the group had to focus their efforts. But their charges, I think, were initially charged with a set of things which, to my mind, are not all simultaneously possible. And the NSI occurred in the same timeline with IANA, and the U.S. government has no interest in administering DNS. As a matter of fact, I think NSF got out of it just in time, right before the CDA, where we could have said, the NSF, you know, is spending money to give pornographers domain names, or something that was even more ridiculous that I can't think of. But I'm sure someone else would have. And then there was early market governance. You know, we'll contract you out and we'll see how your customers respond. But the core problem here, as we're so familiar with in the telecommunications market, is that market governance depends on competition. Oh no, we're back to that first slide again, where it's the thing that has to work. So, what is the current state of affairs? We have a monopoly. And we have ICANN and NSI, which you may hear many people talk about their differences. But here I'd like to say something about them. That is the same. And that to me is a fundamental issue and may not again be discussed here, but for me is a core discussion. They tilt the balance between speech and property towards property. And here's an example of a policy that was made about speech. They said, well, this is a domain name speech. This is clearly a fundamental, important, political, value-based decision. We won't give out certain domain names. What kind of domain name do you have to try to register to get this message at NSI? You have to try to register a dirty word. I mean, one of the... you know, in a scatological word. If all of us came together and said, what is the most pressing issue, the thing that we have to stop from being on the internet? Is it hate? Is it crime? No, it's bodily functions. But, I mean, it's easy to make fun of that, and I couldn't resist. But seriously, whether ICANN will have such rules remains to be seen. It'll be up to the board. So what and how do we decide what is unacceptable? As a huge part of the world comes online where feminism is unacceptable and women's health is pornography, how are we going to come to these decisions? So I'm going to close with what the controllers of DNS can and cannot do and then move out of the way so we can ask questions. They can alter the balance between speech and property, removing a domain name contested as property, which means people, businesses who are built on a domain name are at risk. And they can prevent a specific type of misrepresentation. They cannot prevent misrepresentation. They can prevent somebody from being... you know, www.disney.com, that's not, you know, Disney. They can remove domain names or alter ownership, and they can connect individual responsibility to authorized use of a named domain site. Which is to say, if a user is at a particular domain site, is taking actions authorized at that site, but obviously they can't stop people from breaking into machines. What they can't do, you can't police the internet. They cannot remove a single machine from the internet. The controllers of DNS cannot say, you are no longer connected to the internet. You have sent some very bad packets. And they can't prevent misinformation. And I guess my next slide will probably be my closing slide, I hope. Yes. So what price internet property? What is the cost of erring on the side of speech? What's the cost of erring on the side of property? What's the cost of constructing a governance method, assuming speech, and
and then having property come in, and what's the cost of constructing, which is what is happening now, particularly with the WIPO proposals, and IP and WIPO is not internet protocol, is that it's being constructed entirely as property, and we're just hoping that later speech fits in. So, for which of either can there be remedy? And I'd like to stress again that this problem is getting harder as I speak. The constituency of users and of businesses is increasing and has increased since I began my talk. So, thank you.
Thank you, Jean. And Hans, if you want to come back here, we'll take questions.
As far as the productivity of how the bird lives up to value, observe that Native Americans, the so-called Indians, go to Columbus had a little misunderstanding and somehow it has to get remedied. In this case, all this seems to be based on a misunderstanding of the push hat so much. The two just put together to make it easy to manage IP addresses and MX records and other information, which is the DNS. Unfortunately, he was not limited to the telephone numbers, so he was able to use letters, so you can use English words, and just like in the old days, you can have a little list of IP addresses, you could pretty much guess what university's DNS entry is. But, you know, that doesn't scale. That was a quick hack, just like the internet worked fine before the DNS, and the DNS is necessary to scale it up. The problem is not with the DNS names be such valuable resources, you may have created a lot of policy around it. That's a bug. The problem is that people are using a DNS rather than a directory. So if you want to find a company name, say Cadillac, you don't assume you dial 1-800-CADILLAC. You call up information to ask for the number, and if you want to write it down, in the same sense, you assume you can type www.cadillac.com that you can get a car company in the United States, not a dog food company, not a shoe polish company, not a company in the middle of India. The issue is a real problem now is we put so much meaning and semantics on just a technical mechanism rather than recognizing the sister registry and that we need a messy directory system on top of that. I say messy because if you go and look at John Smith, the phone company is not going to help you find the right John Smith. And the phone company might have the wrong phone number listed. Or it might be a Bell Atlantic user, and Bell Atlantic is a little tardy in selling Pastel. So rather than trying to create a lot of mechanism to use the government around a non-problem, which is just artificial scarcity to match the meaningful names, we need to actually reduce the importance of the problem by kind of trying to get something grad students could do part-time, which is just take the next bakery ticket and give it out. Same sort of IP address you get, which is artificial scarcity to go through the limit.
On organizing information, and I absolutely support calls for research for organizing information on the web, but I also point you to the best and most complete study of search engines, which was in Science probably last year. You can send me an email and I'll give it to you, and it shows that not only do the different search engines not cover the same space, that there is a high probability that there is a large amount of internet space that they don't cover at all. And it may be true that the DNS scarcity is a temporary problem that we will solve with technology, but the same thing might be true of the environment, and the same thing might be true of a genetic tendency towards violence.
Okay.
So I think we should govern it.
Okay, it should be hard for me to perceive people if this is, you know, a basic misunderstanding of what the mechanisms are and the issue. I'll just comment by saying, you assume the phone company works better. The phone company directories are very messy, and what I'm by now is more the phone company directories rather than simple.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Carl Auerbach, Boston Working Group and the Individual Domain Name Owners Association. And I have a fair number of questions. I'm going to cycle through the line a few times. My first set of questions are to Tamar, and there's three of them, and I'll do them, as I said, cycling through. The first one is, And throughout ICANN, and in fact, in a lot of the internet areas, the word consensus is used as a very high ideal. Yet, I am seeing in the way ICANN is forming, consensus is really a form of politically correct word to hide a way for someone who is measuring the consensus to impose their own decision. So what I'm asking is, would it be better to abandon this notion of consensus, this vague term consensus, and go to a more clearly formed voting system where people actually have to raise their hands and say yay or nay to very well-formed issues?
I think the latter, the larger the group, the more diffuse the subject matter, the more diffuse the people, and less personalized the decision is, we move to quantifiable percentage. It simply heads accounting. And you're right. That's my opinion.
I'm the creator of ArcGIS. I am speaking tomorrow. I do have a question. I'm not saying that. And my question is for Dr. Frankel. You talked about the issue of derivative tweets and why you can't have the 5 million messy users all able to do it. So, of course, we have to disenfranchise. I'm sorry if I sort of load it and paraphrase, but there is a question I get to it. The issue I sort of reacted to, and I may be completely misrepresenting the point, but I heard that and I said, that strikes me as a symptom, and a very serious symptom that needs to be looked at. If what we say is, quite frankly, we can't have 5 million people who can sue us, that doesn't mean you disenfranchise the 5 million. You figure out why you feel they have to be there in the first place. And the question, now that I'm actually there, is it all that common in your field that you go ahead and say we'll just get rid of 5 million people and not let them sue? Struck me as a year.
First of all, disenfranchisement means lack of voting rights.
You were going to be addressing the issue of whether they could actually launch a derivative.
Suit. Now, a suit is not necessarily a vote. So you can let people vote without giving them the right to sue on behalf of the corporation.
Is this common?
Yes. And I'll tell you when. Not in corporations and not in membership corporations, whether shareholders, but in the government. You are a citizen of this country. You vote for the political representatives. But you cannot sue the government for anything you want to. The rule is that you can sue the government if the decision affects you personally. For example, if the IRS charges you more than you think you ought to pay. But you cannot sue if the IRS charges me, even though they've done me a horrible harm. Yes? That is, so there is a limitation, and the underlying reason is something like that.
Just one final comment if I'm grabbing the mic one last time. There was a comment made, and I can't remember which one made it, the effect of requiring the consent of the governed. As an internet user from 1987, I would argue that this is the tolerance of the users. And as long as these people don't get in our way, we'll tolerate. I can, maybe not. Put an entirely different spin on it, put it in that term. Do no harm, probably, sort of the best I can try.
May I comment on that? I stop at filing. It doesn't mean that if I'm very displeased with the service and the product that I want to govern them. And that is because I'll go across the street and I'll stop somewhere else. Yes? And then Filene at some point will feel the pain. Excuse Filene, I didn't mean to. But so there are some situations in which exists, in contrast to voice, is better both for the consumer and for the company. Yes? If I am a loyal customer, I may be very angry and I may write to the management. So it is not that I always, if I am a consumer, that I always must have a say in the government, even though this is a service given to me. But in this case, there's a problem because there's no competition. I can't go across the street. So long as I can go across the street, it may not be so important to me.
You know, invite everyone to be here tomorrow and discuss about that.
If it is true, then I'll change my mind.
My name is Todd LaForte. I teach at George Mason University here in Virginia. And I have two observations from the comments that of the panel that put together today. Thank you all for your comments. I think it certainly provoked me. I'm coincidentally reading Robert Dahl's On Democracy for another function altogether, and I have to say the combination between what you all are talking about today and what Dahl as a political theorist has been writing about on democracy fits very nicely together. I have two observations. I think they're observations based on what I've heard, and I wonder if you could, members of the panel, could comment on them. The first is that it seems that there's a connection or a disconnection between our view or the emerging view of consumers or users of the internet and citizens. Someone once commented to me that there is a difference between a consumer and a citizen, and we don't sometimes make that distinction. The second, which came from Gene's comments, I think, is that we may be thinking about there may be an equally important distinction between property holders and citizens. The concept that Dahl talks about in the emergence of our notion, a modern notion of democracy, has been to shift away from property holders, but that was a very common idea in the 19th and even early 20th century, and still that governs the way we think about corporate governance today. And the second observation that I had that I wanted you to comment on was what the connection is between legitimacy and efficiency. It seems that the Internet as a technical creature at its origin has been governed by engineers, and I wonder what the value is or the capacity or the competence is of engineers as politicians, as opposed to businesses as politicians, which seems to be the ICON model, as opposed to citizens as politicians. Flaming seems to be associated with engineering cultures. Dismissal seems to be associated with business cultures. But real participation seems to be associated with citizens' cultures. And maybe you could comment on that, please. Thank you.
Gee, you have been reading your democratic theory. Let me see. The tension between legitimacy and efficiency is a broad one. Let me say one thing. I think that if you plow straight ahead, I think from an administrative point of view, ICANN has made some mistakes. And what they've done is it's plowed ahead trying to be, I think, efficient and effective and get business done. And I think that has strong risks of shooting themselves in the foot, because now they're getting tangled up in legitimacy issues that they might have much better avoided. And if they had better managed the legitimacy, if they put the effort in to make sure that they were engaged in a legitimate process, they would have gotten through it and could get on to conducting some business. But by going straight to conduct business, I think what's happened is they got maybe a short-term gain, and now they're getting all tangled up in legitimacy, they can't run the business, they can't get the business, they're having trouble imposing fees, they're having trouble paying the bills, all those things, because they tried to take a shortcut. That was a big mistake, and that was they shortcut their own administration by focusing exclusively on administration.
What's the difference between engineers and citizens? I believe we've only had one president who's an engineer, and I won't be meeting his president yet. Well, we've had two. Yeah, who's an engineer? Carter. I was thinking about the first one, but I won't be going to. And but those are two examples of engineers who are citizens. And engineers as citizens have a bad reputation that I think is ill-deserved, especially if you look at the act right now of many of the citizens who are engineers who are keeping people, keeping the power on and keeping the water running and hurricanes flowing to disaster areas. All right. Well, I'd say I'm a lousy politician. We do have to comment on this. Engineers or citizens. I think the thing is, in engineering, things are right or wrong. Is that they run or they don't. Now, the problem is, in engineering, the issue is the definition of the problem. And that's an issue here. Like, the definition of the problem is it making your car run or is it not polluting the world while the car goes really fast? So, the issue is that engineers, like businessmen, are extremely good, as Soros says, at playing by the rules. And are not terribly good at defining the rules by which we play.
I think I would add another distinction, and that engineers deal with the physical world like scientists, and politicians deal with the social world. Their rules are different. People are not, better or worse, are not like atoms. So that creates a difference. May I just say one thing about legitimacy? I want to give you an example, and maybe that will be better. Icahn and Dr. Castell posted proposed rules, their rules, the bylaws, and asked for comments. That sounded very democratic and transparent, and people were very frustrated. And I think one reason was because they had no idea of whether those proposals just went directly to the waste paper basket. And when you look at a decision of a court, what you see, both courts and Congress, what you see is an interesting thing, and that is every decision lists the arguments of the parties, whether they won or lost, and gives reasons for those who won and for those who lost. And therefore, this is a signal without saying anything. We heard you, we considered you, and you lost. And people are satisfied with that. That is legitimacy.
Hi, my name is Alan Sullivan. I'm president of Voter Systems. We provide web-based domain name registration services at registerfree.com. We register approximately 2,500 domain names a day, so we get real close to the customer. And I've got some questions for the panel today, and I thank you for participating in this forum. I have an email from one of our employees, and he gives an example of the type of thing that we deal with when just using the internet, okay, as a service provider. One of our customers tried to register a domain name that contained the word Olympic. Now, here's an interesting one where you don't have to use a dirty word. And got rejected due to an agreement with the Department of Commerce. We did some checking and found that there are over 200 domain names that contain the word Olympic in them that were not denied. And of those, only a couple were legitimate uses of the word Olympic from the International Olympic Committee. Allowing some to register these names and not allowing others is wrong, in our opinion, at least from an engineer's viewpoint. He felt this is very unfair and wrote me this letter. We talked to NSI, who is our form of redress. This brings up another issue, is issues of redress. We can only go to NSI. We went to our NSI rep, gave them a call, and they said, talk to NSI's business affairs department. We did that. We called them. They never called us back. Now, if you try to register a domain name with, you know, with the word Olympic in them, we get back an email. Try. You'll get back an email that says, sorry, Olympic is a trademark name. Why do they get to make that decision? Who decides that they get to make that decision? The other questions are, and this is just a question to the panel, just interested. If I want to get an IP address, do you know where I go? Open question. If I want an IP address, do you know who the authority is that I go to? This is where you are geographically, is actually the answer.
You have, well, that's true.
If I'm in North America.
Terribly American.
If I'm an ISP and I'm in North America, I go to Aaron. If I'm somewhere else, I might go to Europe, I go to Athens. In other words, it's broken down. It's kind of out there. Aaron itself happens to be a nonprofit organization. If I need a redress of the domain name, that's a generic top-level name, I have to go to a for-profit company in the United States and get redress from them. If I want to talk to if I want a government resolution list, we might go to the Department of Commerce, because theoretically they control the root service. The point is, we've got a very messed up situation where we have no issue for redress. If they won't give me an IP block, I have no place to redress. If they won't give me a domain name or my customer domain name or my customer IP address, I have no place to redress the problem. I have to go back to the very entity that's controlling that. Yeah. So the question is, what are we going to do about that? Never mind ICANN. ICANN, I think, is trying to be a solution for this redress problem. I will open up the question, well, how do we go about redress? The very fundamental day-to-day problems we face as a business. That's another place. You start your own route, but who do I go to? Department of Commerce? Right, fine. I understand. No, we understand.